It's a packed Playback Daily for Wednesday, the 7th of April, with me, Gemma Craddock. We've got a bit of this.
I really think rugby is a wonderful sport because it just really allows you to value your body in terms of its strength and its power and what it can do and what you can achieve, as opposed to aesthetics.
And this?
I'm looking at who invented the vaccine, who makes the vaccine, who's promoting the vaccine. Those people look like me, they talk like me. And so that gives me, you know, makes me feel safer. Whereas for people from other communities, you know, they're excluded from those types of things.
And even some of this.
Those things that adults would see as being a dopey teenage decision is actually a teenage learning experience for which they're being chemically rewarded in the brain.
So stay with us and let's get going. It's been a unique and taxing time for all of us, to say the least. But time and troubles march on. The everyday troubles that can consume little hearts and minds. On the Ryan Tuberty Show this morning, Ryan spoke with Áine Murray, a primary school teacher with a background in psychology, who's on a mission to normalise children talking about their feelings. And this is where her book, The Pain in the Chest, found its origin.
Yeah, so the book follows a little girl who, she has a lot of big worries, and it kind of shows us scenarios where she wants to do something and is stopped by all these overwhelming, like, what ifs. So she wants to get a balloon, for example, and she thinks, but what if I get it and it hurts my hand? Or what if I get it and I lose my mum? And all of these worries kind of manifest as a pain in her chest. And she's also followed around by this little worry monster who you kind of spot throughout the pages. And you see her kind of when she's seven, she doesn't want to audition for a play because of all her worries. And then she's in secondary school. She doesn't want to make friends because she's too afraid that, you know, people won't like her or they'll think she's weird. And eventually it comes to a point where she wants to have a party and she tells her mum. And her mum's kind of confused because she never knew. She kind of thought she was shy or, you know, never liked balloons or never wanted to be on stage. And the girl finally shares that she does like both things but has always been stopped by a pain in her chest. And when she finally shared it with her mum is able to empathise and validate her feelings and explain that it happens to her too, and explains that when we talk about our feelings, it will make us feel better. And that's the message that kind of the book sends, that we should talk about our feelings.
Right. And I love the examples you picked. You could tell you're a teacher because you obviously know that, you know, some children would be afraid to lose the balloon from the helium goes up to the sky. What do you do next? But also they want to be on stage like all the other girls and boys, the popular ones, if you like, but they don't want to be seen to be different, or they don't want to separate themselves from the crowd. Similarly, making friends. And then I think even she's 18 in the book at the end where she says, I want a party because everyone has parties, but I don't want to be the centre of attention. You know, it's a very difficult sea to navigate.
Exactly, yeah. And
for all comers, parents, teachers, and the poor child, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And she, I suppose, never had the language for it, and the mum then gives her that language and explains that it's very normal to have these feelings. You know, we all have them, and if we talk about it, we can do the things we want to do. We don't have to let the pain in the chest stop us from doing those things.
I keep quoting Shrek every time, better out than in, Fiona, you know.
Yeah.
But it's so true. He was talking about different things, but ultimately there's truth in it. Now, you worked with Childline for a little while, didn't you?
I did, yeah, I did.
Can you tell me a little bit about what pains in the chest, and the manner of speaking, you heard about at the other end of the phone?
I suppose we, at Childline, we would have heard a lot of, they wouldn't be there to tell us about their worries, they'd be there just to have a chat with us. And it was kind of a place where children could talk to someone and tell us about their day, and had someone there to listen in a very kind of non-judgmental, non-directive way. They could tell us whatever they needed to tell us without being told what to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's very helpful to bring into a classroom as well as a teacher, because, you know, children, it's helped me center any issues that children have around, like, thoughts and feelings. That was very adamant in Childline, that everything was around thoughts and feelings, because while context can change, and context is important, but context can change, like people's perspectives on situations can change, and thoughts and feelings are very real, and for children.
So you would be the independent ear guiding them to, well, encouraging them to talk, because that can often be a hard thing to do if somebody does have the pain in the chest, a child particularly, is you can't coax the problem out of them. Did you ever have a thought about that in terms of how do parents get to the place where the child feels comfortable explaining what's wrong?
Yeah, I think just assuring children that they can talk, that that you're always there, and they're not making sure you're not forcing them or like trying to coaxing it out of them, but just assuring them that you will be there to listen. And you know, things that I've done for children that I feel that are upset, even things like getting them to, you could get them to draw a picture if they're not comfortable to talk, or if there's something like a song that they feel represents their feelings, maybe you could show us the song, and just letting them know that they can tell us in a way that suits them, but without forcing them, you know.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Anya, was the return to school. And I think that adults will have a version of it when it comes back to returning to the workplace. But let's talk about kids going back to school, particularly for the bunch of kids who haven't been for ages and ages. At least some have gone back. But after Easter, there's a whole bunch of school going, not children, but there's young adults, some of them, who are going back. It's not easy. And, you know, we shouldn't assume that they're going back, they're all going to be delighted. I mean, it's almost re-socialising again.
Yeah, it is. I mean, for a lot of kids, it was amazing to be back, and they did really miss that connection and sense of belonging. But for a lot of other kids, they were quite comfortable at home, and coming back was scary for them, and having to do group work and comparing themselves to other children. But it's even more important that those children are back, because you can't go on life without socialising with your peers, you know?
Yeah, go ahead.
I do also think that, like, I know you say, you know, academics isn't a big worry, but I do think a lot of children feel like they're expected to do, like, this. So I teach fourth class, and
yes,
I think they're expected to be at a fourth class standard. And a lot of language is going around at the minute that the children are, like, falling behind in their academic skills, as well as their social skills, I suppose. But I do think that can be very damaging, because the idea that they're falling behind, like, falling behind who, you know, like, it's them against them. And, you know, it's very important to assure them that if they can't do something, that is nothing to do with them. That is just, you know, your teacher figuring out where you're at, or looking at what we need to go over again. But you're not falling behind. You're at where you're at, and we'll try to get you further, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It can be worrying for children.
Exactly. And pressure can be felt in a house from the top down. So parents should equally just be aware that don't be killing yourself with pressure and worry about the schoolwork and the academic side of things. It'll all fall into place in due course. It is a pandemic. It's every 100 years. Everyone, take a breath. You know, and nothing is as it should be. And that goes for so many different walks of life at the moment. One last thing I want to ask you about, Anya, is regression. And I know a lot of families are dealing with children, you know, some whose SNAs are out of the picture at the moment and what have you. And they've just taken two steps back, which is heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I suppose it is. It's, again, like, you just have to say, take them as they are. Don't feel like it's, you know, take it step by step and day by day. And, you know, it's always, as teachers, you know, you're looking at the child and you're starting with the child. You're not starting with what you think they should be at. Just start with right now and work from there. But yeah, I understand. Like, it is very difficult.
So you're teaching fourth class.
Yes.
What school are you teaching in?
Ashburn Educate Together National School.
And you're off for the Easter holidays at the moment.
Yes. But I'm looking forward to getting back.
I bet you are. You don't attend the teachers' conferences yourself, do you? Or you don't get involved with?
No.
No interest in that. And are you vaccine-wise, are you happy enough with that situation, the way it's going, or are you concerned?
With which?
The vaccine teachers getting vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, I can't... I'm not going to complain. I'm healthy, I'm young, and someone has to get the vaccine. So, look, I'm happy with whatever's decided.
What Neffet have said, and
yeah,
by them, the government, of course. I hope you have more books to come. Have you on you?
Yeah, that's the plan. Mental health is something I'm interested in. So, anxiety is this one, but we're hoping to in the future look into different aspects of mental health for kids.
Áine Murray, chatting about her book, The Pain in the Chest, on The Ryan Tuberty Show. And you can find that book online at thebookmark.ie. And from primary school kids to the older cohort, teens have had plenty of their own challenges. Having to manage the stress and expectations of living in a pandemic with their brains at a unique stage of development. And the key to helping them is understanding them. On Today with Claire Byrne, Philip was joined by Dr. Sabina Brennan, health psychologist, neuroscientist and author of Beating Brain Fog, to chat about teen behaviour and their brains.
So everybody tends to think of development or brain development as occurring in the early years. You know, we know that kids from age 2 to 7 go through a really critical period of development. But the brain still needs a lot of remodelling before it can function as an adult brain. And so the brain goes through a second critical period in adolescence where significant growth and development occurs. Essentially, the brain gets a complete overhaul in the teen years, and there is extensive remodeling and rewiring of the brain to make the brain ultimately more efficient. So it's kind of based on a use it or lose it principle. Unused connections in the gray matter, which is the thinking part of the brain and the information processing part of the brain, they're pruned away. And then in parallel, other connections in the brain that are being used are strengthened. And the teenage brain is incredibly flexible, which means it's a fantastic opportunity to capitalize on neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to change with learning for achievement and for accomplishment. But the flip side of this is that incredible flexibility it's an increased vulnerability to the adverse effects of stress and drugs and other changes, you know?
I had read somewhere, is it the case that development of the brain continues until age 25 in some people?
Well, approximately in most of us. I mean, the thing is, the brain development is not just contingent on age. It's also associated and shaped by environment and by hormones. And so, you know, it's kind of kicked off at puberty. So the age that someone goes into puberty will influence the development process, as will the experiences that they have, including the parenting they have, etc. But for most of us, our brains aren't really fully developed until early 20s. And the latter, basically the way this remodeling occurs is it starts at the back of the brain with the parts of our brain that are involved in our senses, you know, vision and hearing, and moves through the brain. The last part to develop fully are our frontal lobes. And they're a critical part of the brain, really, that help us to be an adult and behave.
Right. Because these are the parts of the brain that govern emotions.
Sorry, say that again?
Are these the parts of the brain that govern emotions, the frontal lobes?
Well, the frontal lobes in a fully developed brain is sort of the rational part of your brain, and it's very well connected, and it's connected with all the different parts of your brain, and it can kind of make big picture decisions, and it can kind of see the future and see the consequences of actions. So in a teenage brain, when those parts of the brain aren't yet fully connected, basically what can happen is that the teenagers rely on a part of their brain called the amygdala, which is in the limbic part of the brain. And the amygdala is our fear center, our aggression center, the center of our emotions. And so they, instead of using their frontal lobes to make decisions and solve problems, they tend to rely on this emotional part of the brain. And so they tend to have reflexive rather than reflective decision making and behaviors.
Okay.
And that really goes a long way towards explaining the impulsivity and various other behaviors we associate with
eating. Exactly. One of which is assessing risk so very, very differently from adults. I mean, we all went through that business of believing that we were completely immortal when we were teenagers.
Yeah.
Does this explain why teenagers seem drawn to risk in a way that adults aren't?
Yeah, it's rather interesting. Basically, the teenage brain is built to seek out new experiences and sensations. And you know, that's all part of learning, you know? Like, you know, an infant learns to walk by standing up and falling down and standing up and falling down, and you keep recalibrating. So in a sense, that's the way we all learn. It's through trial and error. But the brain is in this stage of flux. And it's constantly seeking out new experiences, risks, and sensations. In the teenage brain, what's driving that actually is the reward that you can get rather than the risk itself. So basically, the reward areas in the brain are particularly sensitive in a teenage brain. So they get a greater sense of reward than an adult would. And basically, the release of and the response to dopamine is enhanced in the teenage brain. So they get a greater buzz out of these things than we do.
But
so
basically,
those
things that adults would see as being a dopey teenage decision is actually a teenage learning experience for which they're being chemically rewarded in the brain.
They are being chemically rewarded. The brain doesn't, make a distinction between what's good or bad at this point. It's just looking to learn. And the more experiences it has, the better it can learn. And so that's really where parenting comes in. You know, I think we really need to kind of understand the brain and help the teens take risks, but safe risks and healthy risks.
Okay.
And help them to process information, you know, in a safe way.
One of the big points of stress in many houses is when teenagers are supposed to be studying, parents will see them listening to music at the same time or have a phone in the other hand and be, you know, multitasking to the point that no adult believes that any actual study and absorption can be going on. But the teenage brain is actually capable of doing that.
Multitasking is really a myth. Nobody can multitask. What we're actually doing is teenagers and adults and anyone who's doing more than one thing at a time, what we're actually doing is task switching. So we're switching from one task to another in minuscule periods of time. And actually, that interferes with the effectiveness and efficiency of the tasks you're engaging in. We're all far better just doing one task at a time. But the teenage brain actually is not very good at task switching. It hasn't even developed the skill as well as an adult would.
Oh, okay, all right.
So it's actually quite the reverse. So really, they are drawn. You see, they're drawn to all these sensations and all these different things, and they really want to be connected, with others.
I must have been
so
multitasking
at
the point in time that I read that. So there is a case then to be made for removing all distractions if you want to see a decent period of study going on.
Yes, yes. And to be honest, what I would say is, you know, to almost bookend study periods, you know, with time for fun and for engagement. I think there's kind of far too much cramming. And, you know, with the way the brain learns, teenager or otherwise, you know, you can only focus and concentrate for about 40 minutes at a time. Physical exercise increases your ability to learn. So I would really encourage, you know, parents to encourage teens to get out and get exercising. Lunchtime is a brilliant time to go for a run or take part in any sort of physical activity because it helps counteract that afternoon dip in alertness. And, you know, this studying late into the night, it's counterproductive. There's only so much information your brain can take in during a day before it needs sleep to consolidate that information and to free up space in your brain to take in new information the next day. So,
and do teens need more sleep approach than the rest of us, or are they just lazy oafs?
they need more sleep than we do, and they need more sleep than their younger selves. So really, most teens are not getting enough sleep. They really should be pushing towards 10 hours sleep at night. In fairness to the teens, their body clock operates at a different time to us, and that's because the teenage brain actually releases more melatonin, and so they are wide awake at night time, and that pushes them to stay up later. And then we have set up society to get them up early in the morning, and so we're sort of waking them before they've had enough sleep. So to be honest, you know, sleep is critical. It's critical to mental health, and teens are particularly vulnerable to mental health issues, depression, stress, etc. So it's critical that they get their sleep, and the best way to do that is regularity. Ideally what we should do is change society and have the kids, teens, going to school much later in the morning. But in the absence of that, they've got to try and retrain themselves and try and really promote good sleep. All the studying in the world is an absolute waste unless you're getting your full night's sleep.
Dr. Sabina Brennan, health psychologist, neuroscientist and author of Beating Brain Fog, chatting to Philip Boucher-Hayes on Today with Claire Byrne. How's this for a midweek shot of inspiration? Catherine Thomas has been sitting in for Ray Darcy this week, and this afternoon she was joined by Elise O'Byrne-White to discuss her twin passions, rugby and animals, and making dual careers out of both.
My dad used to play down Del South Harmstown at the rugby club, and I'd go down every weekend and I'd have a packet of potato crisps and some lemonade, and I'd be watching the matches, and I made some friends down there at 5 years old. The coach's son was called Paddy, and he was a good friend of mine, and I remember one day after the match he was saying, "Oh, are you come training on Sunday?" And I said, "Yep." So I went to my dad and I said, I'm going rugby training on Sunday, and he said, "Sure, no problem. We need to get your boots though." So that was really it. Rocked down on Sunday.
And were you the only girl on the team at that point?
Yeah, I was the only girl. Yeah, I had my gum shield boots, and then I ended up being captain of that boys' team for 5 or 6 years until I had to retire at 12 years old.
Wow. Okay. And so, what was it like being like captain of the boys' rugby team?
Well, I really didn't think of it as anything unusual or anything different. I just loved playing rugby. I really enjoyed, I suppose, running after the ball and the physicality of it at that age. But I remember we play matches at the weekends, and every now and again a mum would come up to me and just hand me a sneaky 5 euro note.
I love it.
And I think...
like fair play to you.
Yeah, I think so. Just saying well done and keep going. So
and did you travel for matches? Like, you obviously went and played different teams and all that as well.
Yeah, sure. We ended up going to London, and we played London Irish on a blitz. I took the plane over and everything, like a whole event. But it was really brilliant time getting to. That was really just the start of it. You know, it was just such a brilliant environment to be in, and great team spirit. I loved it.
And you know what? It's just so lovely to hear you talk like that, because it's so inclusive, and it's just, you know, you get to, you know, that under 12s where it doesn't make a difference. Boys, girls, everyone's included. No one batted an eyelid, really. That's your experience of it. And then you got to 12 and that was it. There was nowhere. It was that what happened. Like, there was nowhere to go then after that.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember the boys going on to under 14s and under 15s, under 16s, and then they had all of this pathway available, and for me it just had to be the end. And I didn't actually question it at the time, but in hindsight it was probably devastating that I had to stop. But that's when I went to secondary school and I started playing hockey, and I didn't think of rugby again until I went to college.
And it's just, I mean, it's so interesting, because as we know, like, the, you know, the level, the drop off rates for teenage girls in sport is so huge. And Sport Ireland recently released a report about teenage girls in sport, and it was just so depressing, because it literally just falls off the face of the earth. And it's like 7%, I think, of girls aged 14 to 15 meet the required daily physical activity levels. And it's just, it's so disheartening. And I know there's a lot of work being done on the area, but I'd imagine it's something that you feel quite passionately about yourself.
Well, I think, it's really obvious, especially as, you know, a girl growing up through those school pathways and realising that on some, like a lot of girls don't identify as being sporty or they don't identify as being athletes. And, you know, I put myself in that category. Some people say, oh, you know, you played rugby at a high level and you're an elite athlete. But I don't think of myself like that at all.
You don't think yourself as an athlete?
No, I generally don't. No, I just found something I loved doing and I kept doing it. So it's just a label that's put on it. And I think that's the problem. Sometimes girls just feel that they don't fit that label. Mm. But, you know, my advice would be that there's definitely a sport out there for you. And rugby is a brilliant sport to try because it's all shapes and sizes, all sorts of positions, and a really diverse skill set. So there's...
I think you're right. I think that sentence, like, I'm not sporty, you know, we're sort of categorised into, you know, the arty one or the drama or the sporty ones at school. And generally, it's like, you know, if you look at sport, whether it's football or Ga or Camogie or basketball or whatever. But there's so many, as you said, there's so many sports that maybe aren't tried and tested or, you know, for kids, for teenage girls to actually, you know, put their hand to and see do they like. And I think that's a really key component going forward in terms of, it's the language we use around it as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the opportunity that has to be available there as well, you know, for boys and girls, that there is that variety of sports that they can try. Mm. And, you know, if they don't like it, that's no problem. But it's the opportunity that's available for everybody.
Mm-mm. And then luckily for Leinster and for Ireland, you did get back into rugby when you went to Trinity.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I remember the first day, it was Freshers Week in Trinity, and I was walking around the stands and there was Trinity Ladies Rugby was the stand, and I said, oh god, yeah, I remember I used to play rugby, and I paid whatever, €2, signed up, and then like everybody else, never went. It was only till after Christmas I decided to give it a go, and I went down for the first session, and the girls were so lovely and so friendly. It was a great environment. I made great friends there. And it was from there that I kind of got back into it, and then I ended up getting selected for Leinster. And you know, my club now is Old Belvedere Women's Club, as which there be a high standard in the AIL. So it's provincial and then international.
Mm. And just even going back, because I know Leinster were doing, like pre-COVID, they were doing pretty well. So how has the last sort of 13 months been?
Oh yeah, it's been really tough, not having that rugby there. And Leinster, you know, I've been there since I was 19 years old, so nearly 11 years now I've been playing for Leinster. And the last two seasons we've had a really, really great coaching staff and management team. Ben Armstrong was our coach, and we've got great support from Leinster. We won the last two interprovincial series, and our games went out to 5 games, and then we had a historic game at Twickenham Christmas, and it was everything was going in the right direction. It was just brilliant standard, and then COVID hit, and it's been kind of nothing since. So
I know, and I know you've been training privately. You've built your own gym, have you?
Yeah, I think I would have gone mad otherwise. Yeah, I made a few trips to Woody's, and I made some cement weights. And built squat racks, and I built a bench.
So when the rest of us were pining the fact that all of the equipment, we couldn't buy anything anywhere because it was all sold out, you were busy making weights from concrete and getting your gym together from Woody's. Good woman.
Yeah, it's actually quite easy. If you just have a plastic bucket and some concrete, you can, and weighing scales, that's all you need.
There you go. I also have to talk to you about your other day job, which is with the DSPCA. So tell me about that.
Yeah, so I graduated with a science degree from Trinity, and then I went back and did graduate entry veterinary medicine in UCD. And my first job when I came out was at the DSPCA, so I've been here over a year and a half, and it's just one of the most extraordinary places to work. I absolutely adore the job. It's a wonderful place. You know, getting to help animals and be involved in the rehabilitation of animals and the rehoming of animals it's just perfect job.
And how has it changed? Because I mean, I know there can't be the same level of visits. You were open, but not open to the public for the last couple of months with people coming to look at dogs and primarily dogs, obviously, is it?
We have all animals, quite a lot of cats and dogs, okay. And we have everything here at the moment. We have a swan and a goat and some pigs and lots of horses. So there really is all kinds of everything. Yeah, but like you said, things changed since COVID. Normally we'd have lots of people coming in, members of the public, walking around the shelter, looking at animals and, you know, loads of kids and volunteers and everything up here. So there's always a great buzz.
Mm.
But since COVID, that's reduced. We're closed now. But as far as our work in the veterinary department and, you know, rehoming, we're still flat out with that. So we're still picking up animals and strays, and
I know puppy farming is always big in the news, and puppies being rescued. You get a lot of that as well, I'd assume.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we've had a lot of seizure of puppies over the last 13 months.
God, it's shocking.
Which, you know, is a sign, I suppose, of what's going on in the background, and that very, very high demand for puppies, and, you know, designer puppies. I suppose people are just looking for them, and you know that's where the push to supply them comes from. But our inspectors do a great job, and we've managed to get a few seizures of puppies that were being transported, and we take them in here. But obviously, there's, you know, they're usually quite sick by the time they get to us, so it's an awful lot of work, and it takes a huge amount of care from the veterinary team and our vet nurses. To try get these puppies to survive even.
Mm-hmm. And do you worry, or all this talk about people getting a puppy during lockdown, which was a big thing for a lot of families?
Yeah. And I think in general, I'm never concerned about people getting an animal, as long as it's considered and they've thought about how that animal will fit into their lifestyle and, you know, do they have enough time and do they have enough money, and, you know, do they have a complete understanding of what they're getting into? But sometimes you hear people about, you know, looking to get a puppy that's kind of cute and fluffy and doesn't bite and doesn't pee on the carpet and is good with kids and is good with dogs. And, you know, you're kind of like, when you hear that, you know, they're not really looking for an animal, you know, they haven't really considered it. But from our point of view, it's been really great for so many members of the public who have thought about that decision, coming up and getting animals from the shelter.
Yeah, who need a home.
We've had a huge amount of adoptions and a huge amount of animals being rehomed over the last year, which is really wonderful. Because,
and they have really helped so many people as well, people living on their own. Kids who've not been at, you know, in school, and sort of bringing families together. And as somebody who has two dogs, I know they really do make a house a home, but they are an awful lot of work. They're not they're not just for Christmas.
No, they're absolutely not.
Come here, Elise. When you hear, like, when I'm chatting to you there, and I was reading all about you, like the phrase role model really sort of came to the fore for me, because you do seem like one. Like, what do you think of the phrase?
It's a positive thing if I can be a role model for someone. I think the key about, you know, being a role model is possibly just doing the things that you love, and sticking with them. And at the end of the day, you might achieve something in that. So, you know, I didn't set out to play rugby or play for Ireland. I love animals. I never planned on being a vet. But I just followed my passions, and then, you know, a bit of hard work, you never know where you'll end up. So I've been very, very lucky, and I think it's nice.
A bit of hard work and cement in a bucket. And what's your advice to girls, and say the parents of teenagers who might have abandoned sport? Because I know there's a lot of parents out there who are trying to find the right words or the right ways to get their girls back into sport again.
I think I would say that just, maybe you don't feel like, you know, you're the sporty type, you're maybe not fast, or you don't feel like you're going to run, you know, in the Olympics, but that doesn't mean that you could be a brilliant athlete, which is how the term that I found myself. Mm. And I really think rugby is a wonderful sport because it just really allows you to value your body in terms of its strength and its power and what it can do and what you can achieve, as opposed to aesthetics, which I think a lot of girls, younger girls, are under a lot of pressure.
Elise O'Byrne-White chatting to Catherine Thomas. During Elise and Catherine's conversation there, they hit on the topic of increased dog ownership. And this in turn has led to apocalyptic levels of dog fouling in certain areas. A poonami, if you will. Dublin City Council has reported a 27% rise in complaints related to this issue and have announced a new campaign to tackle it. On Drive Time, we heard from Dublin City Council's Litter Prevention Officer, Bernie Lillis, and from Passage West, Independent Councillor and Tidy Towns Committee Member, Marcia Dalton, who began.
I'm a member of my Tidy Towns Committee. So Passage West is a town of about 6,000 people. It is on the shores of Cork Harbour, so it's got some really nice riverside walks. It tends to be a bit of a destination for that kind of everyday walking, and people bring their dogs. So dog fouling was an ongoing problem, and Cork County Council has had a long time policy of not providing dog poo bins, as we call them, dog fouling bins more correctly. So through the Tidy Towns committee, we applied for grants over the course of 3 years, and each year in succession we provided a bin in a different place on the waterfront, and we became a 6 month contract for emptying. Now when the 6 months ran out, we carried on the emptying. And when I say we, I mean me. And my husband has in recent years kicked in. A big bag burst over me one day and he said, no more. And he took over since. So what we've seen during the lockdown, to come back to your original question, is that the number of times per week that we have to empty it has multiplied several fold. We used to, in the off season, do it once every 2 weeks. In the on season, we do it once a week, and it was reasonably under control unless something went wrong. Now my poor hubby is emptying it 3 times a week. We've 2 bins left, I should add. One has been converted to a litter bin because we couldn't keep up with it at all. But the other two he is now emptying 3 times a week. The volume of dog waste has gone up, but clearly the volume of it being collected and correctly disposed of has gone up. It's also full of coffee cups, and dog fouling bins typically have a relatively small volume, so they don't hold much except dog foul, and they can't deal with coffee cups. So that's what we're seeing over lockdown, typically.
Okay, well, Marcia, the people of Cork owe you quite a favour, running around the place in your spare time emptying dog poo bins. So the obviously, as you say, the bins are getting to overflowing, or they're getting full much more quickly. Are people leaving bags behind then in different places?
Yeah, they do. And, you know, sometimes if we miss a day, or if a coffee cup jams in the lid of the bin, it's one of those little envelope bins, you know. People tend to leave, not everybody, obviously, but some people leave the bags on the bin or beside the bin, and then it looks like a mess. So the voluntary effort that's trying to do good turns to bad, which is really unfortunate. Mm. And then on other occasions, you'll see people, not as much as we used to, but it's still prevalent, tossing the bag maybe onto the branch of a tree or hanging it off the railing along the waterfront. And they say there's no bin, you know, and truthfully, there may be no bin other than the dog poo bin, or the dog poo bin may be further away and they don't want to carry it. But unfortunately, you've gone from what was a biodegradable piece of matter to something which is wrapped in plastic and now no longer biodegradable. So, you know, there's really no answer for it other than to carry it to either where you can dispose of it in any bin, doesn't matter if it's a fouling bin or otherwise, or home.
Okay.
And that's the truth.
Okay, stay with us, Marcia. I'll turn to yourself, Bernie, because I know there's going to be a campaign from Dublin City Council in relation to this to tackle the problem, which would be very welcome if it works. What is it exactly you're planning to do?
Well, thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about our dog fouling campaign. Basically, what we have organised is a suite of outdoor and digital adverts. And we have a number of radio ads. I'm doing a number of radio interviews. And we're also going to install a number of audio devices throughout the city. We're also putting signage on our bins to say you can use this bin to dispose of your doggy bags.
Okay, but so regular bins that you see around the place.
Yes, because dog poo just goes into general waste. And the message that we want to get across to people is, obviously, when you're going out to walk your dog, bring a doggy bag with you or some means of disposal, and to bag it and to bin it. Don't be putting it on branches of trees or on walls or on footpaths. Put it into the bin.
And when you say loudspeakers or audio messages, how exactly will that work, and how frequently will people hear those messages? Where will they be?
Well, they will be in areas that we would describe as black spots throughout the city, and there will be an audio system in place which will obviously welcome people and dog walkers to that particular area. It will remind them that if they need to clean up after their dog, and to bag it and to bin it. So what we're hoping is, and I'm urging people, you know, to clean up after their dog, is that when they see the outdoor messages and when they hear the message as well, that, you know, they will finally understand and change their behaviour, because the behaviour at the moment is it's unhealthy, it's antisocial, it's very dangerous. You know, there are people who are using our public spaces, our footpaths, who are wheelchair users, who may be visually impaired. There are parents with buggies and, you know, who are walking along with little toddlers.
Yeah, Bernie, and I think I don't think you have to convince anyone really who has dealt with it about how unsavoury it is and how much we'd all like to fix it. But in terms of the reaction we're getting from people, I'll give you just one or two of the texts we've got in. It's all very well saying, take home your bag of dog poo. I have two dogs, says this person. I might have three or four bags of poo. I might want to continue my walk. Sometimes it's not practical to bring home the poo. What's the problem with providing bins for dog poo? That comes from Una. Another person says, put in more bins if you want to get rid of poo on the street. The bins in Bushy Park are always jammed full. Where are people supposed to put the bags of poo? And it goes on in that vein. Everyone is saying, give us more bins and we'll bin the dog poo. Is that maybe where the problem is, rather than having loudspeakers?
No, I think that the problem is that people need to take responsibility. If people have dogs, it's their responsibility to dispose of their dog poo appropriately. And there are bins provided. I'm not in the operations part of Dublin City Council that provide the dog bins. I'm here to talk about people, to remind them to clean up after their dog.
But Bernie, you're the litter prevention officer, and I suppose the question is there anywhere to put the litter? You know?
Yes, there are bins provided, and as the councillor mentioned earlier on, sometimes the bags are just left beside the bins. Mm. We have adequate bins provided for them, and if they would only put them into the bins, and that's why we now have to put signage on the bins to ensure people know they can put the bags into
Marcia, the just briefly then, I'll give the last word to you on this. What's your sense of it? You've been in the business for quite a while now. Is it that people, most people are willing to do the right thing, put their bin the poo, but there's no bins for them, or do you think some people are just trying to get away with it?
Well, actually, I think, good luck to Bernie, by the way. I really hope the campaign works or helps, even in some small way. I think people's behaviour has improved. And I may not be speaking what other people are speaking. I think there's just more people walking. And I have to say, now, completely anecdotally, and my own opinion in my own place, almost everybody I see walking a dog on a lead whose dog poos, I have three of them, so I'm with Una, you know, my dogs poo too, they're picking them up.
Hopefully Passage West isn't the outlier here. Bernie Lillis and Marcia Dalton chatting to Sarah McInerney on Drive Time. While we have plenty of people clamouring for vaccines, there are others who view it with suspicion. Doctors and community leaders are finalising their plans for information campaigns and walk-in COVID vaccination clinics to combat the high levels of vaccine hesitancy in groups including the homeless and non-Irish nationals. Barry Lenehan had more on Today with Claire Byrne.
The latest polling for the Department of Health by Amoric Research, which has been tracking public health attitudes to the pandemic, it shows that as of Monday, 71% of people intend to definitely get the vaccine when offered it. Another 15% say they'll probably get it. But 41% of unvaccinated people say they have concerns about getting the jab, the highest this figure has been so far this year. Now, of course, addressing vaccine hesitancy, as we know, all important in achieving herd immunity, and levels of hesitancy here, they are lower than in other European countries. However, researchers at Maynooth and Queen's University found how the most resistant to vaccination here are likely to be female of non-Irish ethnicity, live in a city, earn a lower income and have an underlying health condition. International evidence overwhelmingly points as well to how Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups are not only more likely to get COVID-19 and get sicker from it, they're also less likely to take the vaccine. Professor Cliona Ní Chealaí is consultant at infectious diseases at St James's Hospital. She's been telling me more.
They're more likely to get severe COVID for two reasons. So they're more likely to be working in jobs in which they're in contact with people and they pick it up, and to be living in overcrowded conditions. For example, like direct provision is one example, or, you know, for example, a lot of Roma people live in very, very crowded conditions. And then if they get it, they're more likely to get very sick with it, to get very severely unwell. And some of that is to do with the stress of their lives. It affects your immune system. It stops your immune system from being able to fight viruses as well. And also, certainly in countries where Black people are minoritized, so where, you know, the majority is white, like in the UK and in the US, people with darker skin tones, so people who are Black, people of Asian backgrounds, they are more likely to get severe COVID. And we're not sure why that is yet. And unfortunately, then, those are also the groups in which there are often the highest levels of vaccine hesitancy. So that's, you know, where people don't feel safe to get the vaccine. And there's a lot of things that feed into that. So, for example, you know, if I'm looking at who invented the vaccine, who makes the vaccine, who's promoting the vaccine, those people look like me, they talk like me. And so that gives me, you know, makes me feel safer. Whereas for people from other communities, you know, they're excluded from those types of things. Is no Black person on NIAC, for example. It makes it seem that little bit less safe. And I suppose for Black people, for example, and for Roma people, you know, for Black people in the US, they were used as subjects without being told in experiments, in medical trials over the years. And Roma people have also, you know, for example, would have had forced sterilizations and other really unpleasant interactions with the medical profession and with the state, you know, policemen, hospitals, the government. That trust isn't there to the same degree. That's why, you know, for me, it's an automatic. I see somebody in a doctor's coat and I trust them, but that's not always the way for everybody. So that's why vaccine hesitancy can be higher in those groups.
How do you win that trust?
It takes time. No better time to start than now. Certain groups are more hesitant about vaccines, you know, and absolutely we need to address it and start now, because it's not something that necessarily, you can't necessarily build that trust overnight. So if we're thinking about, you know, inviting for people for vaccines in a couple of months, we need to start engaging their communities and looking at answering any concerns they may have now, so that we're not in a situation in which we've left it too late. And really, we're keen that those are the ones that get protected the most, rather than unwittingly that they end up unprotected because we haven't addressed their vaccine concerns.
Cliona Ní Chealaí there. There's an issue here, Barry, that a lack of evidence or data collection by the HSE around how COVID has impacted on minority groups. What are they saying? What are the communities themselves saying about vaccination?
Yeah, well, the Polish community makes up the largest group of foreign nationals living in Ireland. And according to research by the science journal Nature, Poland is second only to Russia on the list of countries most suspicious of the vaccine. Last month, an opinion poll in Poland asked people would they take the AstraZeneca jab. 39% of people said they had fears and weren't going to take up their vaccination appointment. However, it's important to point out how there are no major concerns around vaccine hesitancy expressed in the Polish media here. In recent days, Translate Ireland, a group founded by our former colleague Graeme Clifford, it released vaccine information videos in 36 different languages to help reach people who largely live isolated from the Irish media.
And what of the traveller community?
A recent report by Pave Point identified vaccination hesitancy as a major issue among travellers. It found how they're particularly fearful over how quick the vaccine was developed and that they're significantly influenced by misinformation, including a myth being shared online that you don't need the vaccine if you already had COVID because you can't get COVID twice, it said. The report also noted misleading messages from religious sites that may be used by travellers, as well as misleading advice from some perceived and trusted religious individuals. Traveller organisations say they shared information of Pope Francis receiving the vaccine to help negate some of this, but admit it didn't help to the extent they had hoped.
Is it an issue, Barry, that in all of the public health campaigns, these communities are not going to be seeing one of their own out in front, inducing and encouraging them to go and get the vaccine?
This was an issue identified by Pave Point and also something mentioned to me by Joy Tindai Kangeri, co-founder of Roots in Africa Ireland. Now, last week in the UK, you had the actor and comedian Lenny Henry. He wrote an open letter to Black Britons urging them to get vaccinated amid considerably lower levels of uptake. Nothing similar here as of yet, but Joy also told me how community organisations are busy spreading information.
The huge issue is how quick the vaccine was put out from the starting of the pandemic. Because of all that has happened, we have to go back to the historical past examples where medical experiments, sometimes dangerous to Black and brown people, were taken on. You look in, you know, people are looking at areas like in the US where there was the Tuskegee experiment. And these are issues that raise that you cannot differentiate between past historical factors and what is happening now, whether this is, you know, something that will prove to be an attack on vulnerable Black and brown people.
There's a high relevance of the legacy of discrimination that many communities have suffered in the health system in years and decades gone by, playing into this as well, and the uptake around the coronavirus vaccine.
When we're looking at an island perspective, the mother and baby homes, a lot of vaccines were tried on Black and brown children that were in the mother and baby homes. And that is a legacy that is passed on within communities. The socioeconomic factors do play in, because we also don't have high population of Black and brown people that are in the age group that is receiving the vaccine. So we're looking at those that are in the highest category, being from, let's say, 75 plus. We don't have those numbers coming in. And also the reporting on the efficacy of the vaccine, because we don't get any figures. There's no stratification of information on the numbers of people within the community that have been infected by COVID. Also, the language barriers that are within the communities. We are left with so many questions surrounding, is it safe to take the vaccine?
What of the work undertaken by people like yourself to answer those questions? What challenges have there been?
We have a situation in Ireland that there isn't a lot of representation, authentic representation of people that would be able to say, you know, if I have a question, if I'm going to ask someone that looks like me, there's only a small population of Black and brown medical professions, or someone that can trust and say, look, I've suffered medical racism in the past. Can you tell me the truth? Is this vaccine safe? I mean, the lack of even women in combating and having their voices heard. Compare that to having migrants or Black community being, you know, invited to the podium. That is something that is not happening in Ireland.
Joy Kangeri. There's another issue here, Barry. How easy or difficult is it going to be for doctors and health workers to actually identify within the homeless community, I'm thinking, perhaps also Roma community, who it is that needs to be vaccinated and actually getting them vaccinated?
Yeah, and those communities will find it hard to access mass vaccination centres, organisations say. So yesterday, I visited a planned walk-in vaccination clinic in Dublin City Centre. This idea to combat those, to access those communities. It's a hospitality venue being turned into a setting where homeless, Roma and other vulnerable groups can get the vaccine without appointment if they wish, or merely ask questions on it if they have concerns. Now, remember, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee, it has given priority to travellers, homeless and Roma people, and charities that are out there, they're working to get these people inoculated, but vaccine hesitancy remains stubbornly high. GP Dr. Angie Skuse is the medical director of the charity Safety Net Primary Care, and Maxine Radcliffe, she's a clinical manager for social inclusion at the HSC. They're putting this walk-in clinic together. They've also been running a COVID isolation unit for vulnerable people. And Maxine, but first Angie, have been telling me of the challenges ahead in convincing these communities they work with to take the vaccine.
We knew that the people that we look after, that we provide care to, would not be able to access the vaccine in the way that the general public would. An awful lot of them don't have GPs. A lot of them don't speak English, so can't contact a GP. Many of them are not literate in any language. The fears and the rumours that are circulating aren't specific to the COVID vaccine. They're ones that come up every time there's a vaccine campaign anywhere in the world. The way to allay those fears, I think, is not to sort of address them specifically. really. It's to build trust.
When we opened this facility at the beginning, I had people who had COVID, who were isolating in rooms, who were literally terrified. And I was coming as a nurse to check on them, and they would be convinced that I was there to inject them with something that would make them unwell because they were so anxious. Now, I would see those people in the street, they'd be smiling at me, they come to us with problems. We've built trust, and so people are more open to receiving help from us. So people have come to me and said, what do you know about the vaccine? They haven't said directly that they want to have it, but they're asking us questions, so we're seen as trusted authorities.
You were reporting people were, you know, vaccines or injections for pregnancy or for children, that people were saying, actually, don't give me that. We think it's the COVID vaccine.
People backed away when I opened the vaccine fridge. And there were people who might have had the flu vaccine the year before. So that's what I mean about the fear not really being rational or not being specific to the COVID vaccine. The fear had spread into, don't do anything to me, I don't quite trust you.
Were you dealing with a significant proportion of COVID denying or disinformation, or is that still an issue?
Definitely still an issue. I think a bit less so, but it's definitely still an issue. We have patients at the moment who have COVID and don't believe they have COVID. Patients in hospital even. Patients I know in the last week, I know of two people who self-discharged from hospital with COVID on oxygen, very unwell, and we were sending ambulances out to get them. And I don't know if it's really that they disbelieve in COVID or that they're just afraid and they want to be at home.
What sort of uptake do you think there is within the Roma community then in terms of the vaccine, or what are you projecting at this juncture? Is it possible to say?
So I think numbers will be very small to begin with. It would be the wrong approach would be to open a mass vaccination centre and start booking people in. Our only limitation really is that the vaccine that we're getting comes in 10 dose vials, and those 10 doses have to be used up in one day once it's been opened. So if we got 10 people a day, then we would be happy. We will then be relying on word of mouth. So when people get the vaccine and do okay afterwards, they will spread the word. And we will be asking people to do that. People are in WhatsApp groups and things that obviously we're not in. So we will be actively asking people that if they have the vaccine and if their experience is okay, to circulate that among their groups and their communities.
I think it's going to be initially very challenging, but I think it could snowball quite quickly. We're not going to be operating a scenario where you have to go online and log in and prove lots and lots of different things. We will be verifying people our own selves in terms of knowing that they're from a vulnerable group and knowing that they, you know, need to receive the vaccine.
And how do you know the cohort of vulnerable people within the wider area?
There's a lot of crossover between the homeless population and the Gypsy Roma traveller population. So 17% of homeless people are travellers in Dublin.
They're the very population that aren't on a database, really. And that's really who we're focused on.
Dr. Angie Skews and Maxine Radcliffe ending that report from Barry Lenehan on Today with Claire Byrne, with Philip Boucher-Hayes at the helm for the week. And that's your lot for today. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back tomorrow.